Salatu wassalam ala sayyidina wa nabiyyina Abil Qasim Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Wa ala ali bayti tayyibin tahirin. La siyama maulana wa sayyidi sahib al-asri wa zaman. Ruhi wa arwahu al-alamin lahul fida. Wa ajalallahu ta'ala farajuhu sharif. Wa lanatu da'imatu ala a'da'ihim wa munkiri fada'ilihim ilalani ila qiyami yawm al-din. أما بعد رب اشرح لي صدري ويسر لي أمري واحلل عقدة من لساني يفقهوا قولي. For the hastening of the return of our 12th Imam, Imam al-Hujjah, one salawat upon Muhammad and Ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you. So this week we want to continue on in our tafsir sessions. So this is actually a continuation and a culmination of Surah Hujurat, which we were doing on the Friday nights, and we had only a few verses left to go over. And so we thought we'd use this opportunity to, first of all, obviously complete that Surah of the Quran, and secondly, to hopefully get some better understanding of the ayat of the Quran, and especially Surah Hujurat, because it is probably one of the most important chapters of the Quran. Obviously, the entire Quran is important, but the fact that Surah Hujurat emphasizes on the ethics and morality of a human being, of a Muslim, and how our interaction with the Muslim community, with non-Muslims, with the world around us, really, because this chapter talks about so many of those instances of how our morals should be based upon the Quranic ethos, we wanted to obviously go through this and better understand how our believer should mold their own character and morality on the basis of the Quran. Today will be our final discussion of this chapter. So this would be session number 13. And we're going to look at two verses, verses number 17 and 18. And so for those who will recall from our previous discussion, the last few verses of Surah Hujurat, if you want to look it up on your phone, it's Surah number 49 of the Quran. Again, verse 17 and 18 we'll look at tonight. The end of the chapter, Allah was speaking to the A'rab, which, as we talked about, were the Bedouin Arabs. Now, the Bedouin Arabs were unique because of their mindset, their mentality. When you think about the Bedouins or the A'rab, as Allah refers to them as, we can picture them in our own day and age as being people who are country dwellers. So we have people, let's say, who live in Edmonton, who are city dwellers, and we obviously have a particular way of life. Our culture is in a certain way. But those who live on the farms, who live outside of the main city, you know, a life of farming, for example, where their whole life is, you know, rotates around dealing with livestock, with crops, with maybe very little interaction with human beings, their culture, their mode of interaction is sometimes a bit different than people who are, let's say, you know, university educated, who live in a large metropolis. You'll sometimes see these nuances between certain people at this way. At the time of the Prophet, it was no different. The Bedouin Arabs were those who lived outside of the main city of Mecca or Medina. They were basically nomads. They would travel from, you know, city to city, from watering hole to watering hole. They didn't have a fixed address, and because their entire life revolved around, you know, grazing animals, looking for the next watering hole, they didn't have a lot of interaction with humans, right? They didn't do a lot of business dealings, trading, commerce, and so on and so forth. So their level of intellect, in a sense, was not as refined. Their cultural, the way that they dealt with people, was not as polished as, let's say, the elite of the city life. And so Allah is speaking to them at the last few verses of Surah Hujurat, but also showing that, you know, their coming into Islam, as Allah says, was not a full conviction in Islam. It was more, maybe we could say, a religion of convenience at one level, because they had just come into Islam, but they weren't really committed to the religion. And it would take them, obviously, years and years to become more devoted and committed to Islam. And Allah does recognize the fact in the Quran that some of the Arab, as Allah says, some of these desert Arabs, they are truthful in their Islam. So some were actually devotees of Rasulullah. They actually believed in the mission and the message. But others, they really weren't at that pinnacle of belief and conviction in Islam. So the two verses I want to look at tonight, the first verse looks at the Arabs, these desert Arabs, taking Islam as being, you know, something that they felt that they were doing Allah a favor by becoming Muslims. And so the verse says the following, يَمُنُّونَ عَلَيْكَ أَنْ أَسْلَمُ. These Bedouin Arabs tell you, O Muhammad, that you owe them a great deal, that you owe them a favor for coming into Islam. Allah replies to them, Allah tells the Prophet, tell these Arabs, قُلْ لَا تَمُنُّوا عَلَيَّ إِسْلَامَكُمْ بَلِ اللَّهُ يَمُنُّ عَلَيْكُمْ أَنْ هَدَاكُمْ لِلْإِيمَانِ إِن كُنْتُمْ صَادِقِينَ. So they would come to Rasulullah and say that we're Muslims, we've done you a favor, Prophet, by converting. As if the Prophet wanted them or needed them to convert. So they came to Rasulullah and said, look, we're Muslims, we've done you a favor by coming into Islam. Allah replies to them and Allah tells them, say that you are not doing me any favor by you embracing Islam. In fact, it is Allah, it is God, who has done a great favor by guiding you to the faith. Think about this if you are people of truth. When we look at it, even at the level of you and I today, you know, sometimes we get into this fixation that, well, I'm a Muslim. I came into Islam. I pray. I fast. Why doesn't Allah give me what I want? You know, I've heard this sometimes from some people that I've been a Muslim 50 years. I've prayed. I've gone for Hajj. And sometimes we say that in a condescending way, in a way that, Allah, I have spent my whole life worshiping you. What have you done for me? Right? This is sometimes an understanding that sometimes we as believers might fall into when we make dua to Allah for something. And maybe that dua doesn't materialize right away. We say to ourselves, Allah, I spent $10,000 to go to Hajj. I spent $5,000 on ziyarat. I spent nights fasting till late at night. What did you give me out of it? And so this was something that the Arabs at that time were doing. They felt that they were doing Allah a favor, or they were doing Rasulullah a favor by coming into Islam. And Allah tells us that, don't think that you're doing me a favor. This Islam that you have, this is good for you. It's going to benefit you in this world and the world to come. So we're not doing Allah a favor by coming into religion. This is, again, only a benefit for you and I. It has no bearing on Allah. Tomorrow, if all of us were to leave Islam and become non-believers, Allah would not become a lesser God, right? If the whole world began to worship idols, Allah would not cease being Allah. He would still be Allah. It wouldn't hurt him. It wouldn't affect Allah. It would affect the individuals. And so this is something that the people would come to the Prophet and they would tell him and he would respond to them. And really, when you look at it, I want to share a couple examples with you. Is we have to really appreciate where we are at as Muslims today. Indeed, we have challenges, we have problems. You know, we are all suffering in different ways. You know, some of us it's more apparent than others. But really, if you look at where we could have been today, and I mean, many of us come from Hindu background, for example. We came into Islam only 2, 3, 4, 5 generations ago, maybe, even that. You know, many of us were worshiping of idols back when our forefathers were in India, right? Many of us came from ideologies and systems where if we were to analyze it and study it today, we would see how much more, I don't want to say advanced, but how much more blessings we have being in Islam, how much more of a, maybe I can say a sensible way of life it is that we follow. I'm sure we have questions and we have sometimes misgivings and doubts about Islam. Why do we do certain things in certain ways? And that's acceptable. We can question those things. We can seek to understand why did Allah put certain things in our religion. Sometimes things are difficult. Right? And maybe we question, why did Allah make our life so difficult? And it's a valid question to have. But when you reflect on where we came from and where people are today, I'll give you two examples. We realize that this, being as Muslims as we are today and having our children as Muslims and inshallah our grandchildren following this path, it is definitely a blessing that Allah has given to us. You know, it's not that we, you know, that we could even pay Allah back for this. It's something which is really a benefit that we have been given as Muslims. Let me give you two examples. This is a real store in India, the cow urine therapy clinic. As you know, maybe you don't know, but there are humans today on earth, maybe over a billion, that consider cow urine to be sacred. They drink it. They actually have soft drinks made out of it. They use it in forms of many acts of their life. It sounds strange, but this is a reality. It's a strange reality, but it's there today, right? And we have to just realize that we were once in that category, our forefathers, two or three generations ago. We're not too far away from that. They get to the extent where the feces of the cow is considered holy and sacred. They rub it on their face. They use it in their cosmetic products. There are many other examples. You can Google them and you can see at what level that there are people on this earth. And then you reflect on Islam and what Islam had brought, that Rasulullah brought this religion free of superstitions. You know, all of these superstitions, even that we have in Western society, Friday 13th being bad. You go into most buildings, there's no 13th floor on the elevator. You'll see it goes from 12 to 14. Walking under a ladder, a black cat, all of these superstitions, these are simple. But when you look at other religions out there, you see at how, at what level they have reached to in terms of their understanding of God. And you understand and hopefully appreciate how much Islam has actually given to us and given to actually humanity and civilization on a whole. This is just one example that's out there. This was another interesting article, which sounds like something from a satirical website, but it was actually an article and research done that they said that in Gujarat, they found traces of gold in the urine of a specific breed of cow. And they had a research done over 5 years. 500 experts had studied cow urine for 5 years. And they found, apparently, that there are small traces of gold in cow urine. Because the cow is holy, they worship it. It's so sacred that they find that there's even gold within the urine. And, you know, just, again, you think about it, and maybe it's there. Or maybe these 500 scientists are completely out to lunch. Whatever the case may be, when you reflect on the wisdom that Islam brought to humanity, right? There are books, for example, even National Geographic published a book called 1001 Inventions that Muslims have given to humanity. And you look at what Islamic civilization, what the scholars of Islam have given over the last 14 centuries, and the, you know, science and medicine and technology in so many areas. And then you begin to reflect on the return that Islam has given to humanity. And then we see that what kind of a blessing Allah has given to us by being Muslims. Now, obviously, I don't mean to denigrate any other religion or any other belief system, but obviously we realize that, yes, as Muslims, we are told to live in respect with other traditions. We're told to respect other human beings regardless of their religion. But at the same time, we don't believe in pluralism, that all religions are going to heaven or that all religions are equal. We respect Muslims, we respect Christians, Hindus, Sikhs, Buddhists, Jews, all of them we respect. But when it comes to ideology and religion, we're not going to say that all are equal, that all are paths to God or paths to Allah. Salu ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. So a few of the points that we can learn from this particular verse. One is that when we're being guided to Islam and accepting this religion, that this is actually the greatest blessing that Allah has given to us. And it's a debt which we owe to Allah, which we need to pay back. And obviously payback will happen on the Day of Judgment through our actions in this world. We also see that Allah has no need for our submission, our faith, our worship, or any of these actions. Allah tells us that don't consider your coming into Islam as being a favor to Allah. Allah doesn't need you and I to pray or fast. Allah doesn't need any of this. These are all actions which will benefit you and I on the Day of Judgment. So Allah doesn't need us to worship Him. We also see that a sign of true faith is that an individual considers himself as owing a huge debt to Allah. Not that Allah owes us anything. So for us to say, why did Allah not do this for me? I prayed for so many years. I gave in charity. I did this. I did that. Allah doesn't owe me anything back. Rather, I owe Allah everything. I owe God everything in my existence for Him giving me life, bringing me onto this path of Islam, and granting me, hopefully, salvation in the world to come. Allah also shows us in this verse that when you come to the Prophet and you speak to him, you may be talking to the Prophet, you may be, you know, interacting with him, you may be even insulting Rasulullah, as ayat of the Quran show, but Allah shows us that when you do that to the Prophet, it's actually as if you are doing that same thing to Allah. So these people would come, the Bedouin Arabs would come to Rasulullah, and they would say that that this Islam, that we have done you a favor by coming to Islam. Allah replies to the Prophet to tell them that you haven't done me a favor, you need to realize that Allah has done you a favor by guiding you. So there is a very close link that Allah has with His Prophet in the Quran. Again, and this goes back to this understanding that in the Islam of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, yes, the Prophet and Allah are two separate entities. Obviously, Allah is the pinnacle. Rasulullah is beneath Allah. But Allah maintains a connection with His Prophet many times. And Allah maintains a connection with the family of the Prophet many times. We've heard the hadith where Rasulullah says that Fatima is a part of me. Whoever hurts her, hurts me. And whoever hurts me, hurts Allah. So Allah sometimes ties the connection between the Ahlul Bayt to Rasulullah, to Allah. So this shows us in the vertical hierarchy, with Allah at the top, Prophet and the Imams and Ahlul Bayt underneath them, that even to hurt a member of the family of the Prophet is as if you are hurting or insulting Allah. So Allah ties these three or these factors close together with one another. And the last few points on this verse, and we'll conclude with the last verse, is that by the believers accepting Islam, they have placed this heavy burden on themselves. But then Allah has even taken a greater step in guiding us to Iman. So meaning that we have put the burden on ourselves, we've accepted this responsibility of Muslims as being those who submit to Allah. But then Allah gives us an added bonus or benefit. Allah says, I'm also going to guide you to Iman. And we talked about this a few weeks ago. There's 18 differences between Islam and Iman. I don't want to obviously go into that again. But those are differences, and that is something which Allah speaks about that He has conferred upon us. So Allah gives us that further recognition, further guidance as being those of mu'minun, or the people with iman, with faith and certainty. And the last point of this verse is that the final goal in our creation is the perfection of the human being. And that is perfection in the perfection of our faith, having complete faith in Allah. And it's not just a mere outward show of Islam, right? Iman, as we talked about last time, is within the heart. When the Prophet and the Imams describe Iman, we say he's a mu'min, she's a mu'mina. It's not, you know, because we can't read what's in the heart. Only Allah knows what is in our hearts. But we can tell on the outward how people manifest their Islam, at what level of conviction they're at. You know, and again, even that's difficult for me to say, because sometimes a person cannot outwardly manifest Islam. A woman might not be able to for certain reasons. A man may not be able to outwardly manifest Islam, what it means to be a Muslim, because of numerous factors. So we're not going to say that because you don't look, quote unquote, like a Muslim, that you're not. Right? But outward showing of Islam is one of the things we have to keep in mind. But as the passage says, even the hypocrites had a superficial show, an outward form of Islam. So Iman, which is within the heart, it resides in the heart. And one of the manifestations is an outward manifestation of how you actually live the religion on the outside. But because the hypocrites also can, you know, manifest and show Islam on the outside, we don't say that that is the only way to judge a mu'min and a Muslim as being, you know, two distinct individuals. Salu ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. And the last verse for tonight and the last verse of this surah, verse number 18, Allah says, Inna Allaha ya'lamu ghayba as-samawati wal ardh wallahu basirun bima ta'malun. That indeed God knows whatever is unseen in the heavens and in the earth, and He is well aware of what you do. Indeed, God is well aware of what you do. So here, as Allah closes off this surah, He talks about the knowledge that Allah has. And Allah describes His knowledge as being infinite. Infinite, that He knows everything within the heavens and the earth. Whatever is in existence, Allah has knowledge of that. And Allah then talks about how He says that Allah also knows that what we as human beings are involved with. So there's a few points I wanted to mention here. One is in relation to Allah and the knowledge. You know, we have this theme in Islamic theology, ilmul ghayb, knowledge of the unseen. And we have knowledge of Allah, which is obviously at the highest level. But then there are certain things which are within the hidden world that Allah allows certain individuals to possess. So there's some knowledge which is reserved for Allah alone. Certain things, and I'll give you one example, only Allah knows. And He won't tell anybody, no matter how close of a prophet or imam or rasul that individual would happen to be. So this notion that sometimes we have that imams have ilmul ghayb is actually a fallacy. It's incorrect. They have ilmul ghayb only where Allah allows them to have knowledge of the unseen. They do not have unlimited knowledge of whatever they want to know. Imams aren't like Allah, where Allah knows everything whenever it is there. We have even a hadith in Al-Kafi. For example, there are chapters of one of our most well-known books of hadith where the ilm, the knowledge of the unseen which Allah has is only with Allah. But when the imams or the prophet want to know something from that unseen, when they intend to know it and Allah permits them to know it, they are given that knowledge. So we cannot say that Allah's messenger knows everything. He doesn't know everything. Only Allah knows everything. And that doesn't mean He is lower in status. No, it means Allah gives him certain knowledge that he needs to know. The imams do not have knowledge of every single thing unless Allah gives it to them. So we have to make that distinction that they don't have infinite knowledge. They know what they know. When they need to know something, if Allah wants them to know it, they are given that knowledge. And we see that in this example here, that there is certain knowledge reserved for Allah. And I'll give you this verse from Surah Luqman, the very last verse, that there are five things that Allah reserves for Himself, at least five. But other knowledge, as we see in the Quran, Allah can give it to His prophets, to the messengers, to the imams, even to non-imams. We see in the Quran, for example, with Lady Maryam alayhi salam, and her being given knowledge from Allah. So even non-infallibles, alaykum salam, are given this knowledge. And we have examples like Nabi Isa. In the Quran, we're told that Nabi Isa, he told Bani Israel, I can tell you what you are eating at home for dinner today. Although I'm not there to see you eat, Jesus says, I can tell you what you're eating in your homes and what you have in your closet. You know, what you're storing at home, your food, I can tell you that. We have examples of Nabi Nuh as well, being telling his community of knowledge of the unseen. We have the famous story in chapter 18 of Nabi Musa and Al-Khidr. And Khidr giving Musa, who is an Ulul Azm prophet, knowledge of the unseen, which Musa didn't know. And he's one of the greatest prophets of Allah. But yet Allah hid certain events from him for a specific reason. Allah gave the knowledge to Al-Khidr, and Al-Khidr teaches Nabi Musa that knowledge. So let me just give you the one example of Surah Luqman, chapter 31, verse number 34. The five things Allah only knows that He does not share with anybody. Allah says, Inna Allaha indahu ilmu sa'a. Surely Allah is He whom with is knowledge of the hour. Nobody knows when the day of judgment will come. People kept saying the year 2000, the millennium, the world will come to an end. Then people said the Mayan calendar ends in 2012. The world will come to an end. You know, many people have preached and given this message, the world will come to an end. Sell your homes, you know, liquidate all your assets. And the date comes, and guess what? They're still on earth. The rapture hasn't happened. You know, God's kingdom hasn't manifest yet. Even our 12th Imam, he is waiting for the time to come. He doesn't know when that day will be. Knowledge of the hour is only with Allah. Not even the Prophet and Imams know when the day of judgment will transpire. This is ilm inda Allah, only with Allah. But then Allah says, وَيُنَزِّلُ الْغَيْثِ, and only Allah knows about where He sends down the rain. Yes, we have meteorologists on television and on the radio and internet who will tell us, you know, there's an 80% chance of precipitation. It's going to snow 10 centimeters tomorrow. Winds will be 80 kilometers an hour gusting from the northeast. They might predict all of these things, but you and I have seen how many times a weather forecaster is wrong. They predict a massive snowstorm and nothing comes down. They predict a warm winter and then we get minus 30, minus 40 with wind chills. So you ask where, you know, you have all this weather forecast, technology, all of this information at your fingertips. How could you have an incorrect weather forecast? It's because Allah knows where He sends down the rain. Allah is the ultimate weather forecaster. He created the weather. He created the entire system. So for us to say that it's going to rain, there's an 80% probability of precipitation, maybe we've gotten to that level, and we have. Science, no doubt, has progressed. You know, we can actually foretell eclipses 1,000 years into the future. We know exactly when an eclipse will happen. I mean, look at our prayer calendar. We know what time Fajr is every day of the year. We don't have to go out and look outside. We trust that calendar. So we have knowledge. Allah gave us that ability. But still, Allah has some knowledge He keeps to Himself. وَيَعْلَمُ مَا فِي الْأَرْحَامِ, He knows what is in the womb of the woman, of the mother. Allah only knows what is in the womb of the mother. Now you might say, well, you know what? We have all this technology. My wife is pregnant. She'll go get a scan. And you'll be able to tell the sex of the baby. Is it a boy or a girl? You'll know, does it have any deformities? Doctors know all of these things. They know, is the child's heartbeat irregular? Is it going to be, you know, handicapped? They know all of these things. So you'll say, well, look, science knows. So Allah says it in the Quran. What more does Allah know? But scholars say that Allah says, وَيَعْلُمُ مَا فِي الْأَرْحَامِ. He doesn't say, وَيَعْلُمُ مَنْ فِي الْأَرْحَامِ. He doesn't say He knows who is in the womb. He knows what is in the womb. Meaning, will it be a boy or a girl? Allah knows. Will it be rich or poor? Allah knows. Will it be a scholar or an ignorant? Allah knows. Will it grow to be a successful entrepreneur, a multimillionaire? Or will it be somebody living on Skid Row? Allah knows every single facet, every single aspect of that child, that fetus, before it comes into the world. Not just is it a boy or a girl, because an ultrasound can tell you and I that today. In a 3D ultrasound, you can get a three-dimensional video of your child in the womb. But Allah says, I can tell you how rich that child will be, when it'll die, what day it'll be born, what time it'll be born. Science can't tell you and I that. That is knowledge only with Allah. And Allah says, وَمَا تَدْرِي نَفْسٌ مَاذَا تَكْسِبُ غَدًا. No one knows what they shall earn tomorrow. We know that if we go to work, we'll get a paycheck, or we hope we'll get a paycheck, right? That's only the very superficial, the very basic understanding of what we can earn. But there is obviously much more depth of what does Allah mean, what we will earn tomorrow. It doesn't only mean our material wealth, how much our paycheck will be at the end of the month, because you and I know that. We know the deductions, how much source deductions will be, how much our tax bracket is. We know all of those things. So Allah knows not only that, but more of what we'll earn, our actions, our rewards. Where is our intention behind what we do? And then the last thing Allah says, وَمَا تَدْرِي نَفْسٌ بِأَيِّ أَرْضٍ تَمُوتٌ. Nobody knows in which land they will die. You know, there are examples, I'm sure there are examples here in Edmonton. I know back home we have examples where people came from far away to visit their children. And they're only going to spend a month or two on vacation in that particular city. And guess what? After 2 weeks, they pass away. They were born in, let's say, India. They lived their whole life, 80 years in India. They came to Canada for vacation, and Allah took their soul in wherever He took their soul. They never planned to die here. They thought they'd die back home, be buried with their friends and relatives in their graveyard. Allah says, nobody knows in which earth, which land we will die. Right? We don't know. We buy our burial plot. We give the Jamaat the deposit that this is my burial plot. I want to be buried by my mother, my father, my brother, my cousins. And there's no problem with it. I'm not saying don't. No, do that. It's good actually to keep a grave ready for yourself. There's actually reward and thawab in keeping a grave ready for yourself. But we don't know if we're going to use that grave. I mean, nobody sitting here tonight can say, I'm going to for sure die in Edmonton. I'm going to be buried for sure in that particular graveyard. Nobody can say that. Nobody knows where they're going to die. We could be on vacation in a tropical destination and pass away. We could go for a ziyarat, and the time for death could approach, and we could be buried, maybe, for example, in Jannatul Baqi or Wadi al-Salam in Najaf. Who knows? Allah knows. And this is where we see the knowledge of on the unseen, of the depth of knowledge of Allah, is very precise and very specific. We might think we know things about our life, but when you look at this verse, we really think and realize that we really know nothing about our life. We know a few things here and there about what we're going to do, what we're going to eat, what we're going to do. You know, when our wife conceives a child, you know, we have that enjoyment that a baby will come into the world. But we know nothing other than the very general overview of all of these events. And only Allah knows the unseen. And so when He says in this Surah Luqman, and also in Surah Hujarat, that with Allah is the knowledge of the unseen, of the heavens and the earth, it's at this level that we understand Allah's knowledge. It's so much deeper than we could ever even imagine or begin to fathom of how much Allah knows. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. And let me close with the last few points on some points that we can learn from this verse. One is that there are many unknown secrets in the universe. You know, what even science today, whatever they've discovered with the telescopes, whatever they've discovered with the the shuttles that they've sent to this into space, all the satellites, you know, looking at other planets, going further into the solar system, all of that we've been able to achieve until today is great, no doubt. But there are still so many unknown secrets of what's out there in the universe. And forget about that, even if you watch a lot of these National Geographic documentaries, you'll see that what's in the ocean, we don't even know. They haven't even mapped the entire ocean. There are parts of the oceans which are so deep, we don't have technology to get that deep. There are creatures in the ocean we still haven't seen in their natural habitat. So, you know, forget about going into outer space. This Earth, we ourselves have not even explored the entire planet that we're on. And we've been here for thousands of years with all of the technology that we have today, Google Maps and Google Earth and all of these things. We still don't know a lot compared to what we are living on. Number two is that sometimes the hidden motives of us human beings are even more complex, more than the mysteries of the universe. And the way that we get to this point is that, as the commentator of this verse mentions, when Allah talks about samawati wal ardh, the heavens and the earth, Allah uses the word ya'lamu. Allah knows the heavens and the earth. He knows what is within them. But when Allah talks about your and my actions, He doesn't say ya'lamu. He says, wallahu basirum bima ya'malun. Allah sees what they do. And if you look in the dictionaries of the Arabic language and the commentaries, you see that the word basir, to have that knowledge of a deeper knowledge, is much more pronounced, much more at a higher level than just knowledge, ilm. So basirat is more deeper in its level of depth of understanding, because Allah doesn't just know our actions. When I pray a 2-rakat prayer, yes, Allah knows I've prayed, He sees the action, but He knows the intention behind the action, which nobody else in the room would know. People might see you pray, but they don't see your intention. Are you praying for showing off? Are you praying for the sake of Allah? Are you praying for the sake of the dunya? Nobody knows but Allah. So when Allah says He has this basirat, it's a deeper knowledge than just the superficial outward knowledge of looking at things. Point number three is that when we look at the sphere of tawheed, of monotheism, the value of a person in the world outlook of tawheed is not based on the apparent or on the verbal declarations or the outward acceptance of Islam. Rather, it's on our sincerity. It's what's deep in our heart. So Allah doesn't judge us necessarily by the physical action. He judges us by the intention, why we're doing a particular action. And again, we've talked about that in the past. I don't want to repeat it tonight. Last but not least, and we'll end with these two points, is that if an individual has true faith in the total comprehension knowledge which Allah has, then we would be extremely careful. Right? If we go into a shopping center, for example, we know that there are cameras all over the shopping center. They record every single movement of us when we walk into the store until we leave. At the cashier, there are cameras. There are probably plainclothes security walking around, looking at people to make sure they don't shoplift. If we had that same understanding of Allah, that He's ever present recording our actions, then we would probably be careful of what we say, of what we do, of what we think. If we knew and if we actually materialized that rationalization in our head, just like when I go grocery shopping, there's security cameras. If I had that in my own life, that Allah has a camera with me 24/7, then that would hopefully change the way I carry myself, not only in public, but more so when I'm at home in my private. I would be careful of what I'm doing. If I'm breaking the rules of Allah, if I'm doing anything in disrespect of the teachings of Muhammad and Ali Muhammad, alayhum as-salatu was-salam. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. And last but not least, and we'll end with this, is that the knowledge of Allah is alongside His discernment of us. His knowledge is not brief or superficial or one-sided. His knowledge is always there. It's deep, it's profound. His knowledge is not only of my actions at a physical, it's also at the spiritual. He knows my intention, which is the most important aspect. And when He knows the intention, really the physical doesn't make a difference because the intentions are what our actions are based upon. And so when we realize this, we realize that Allah is ever present in our lives and that we have to be careful of our actions. We close and we ask Allah as we conclude this review of Surah Hujurat. Yes, you have a question? Sure. This one here. Okay. Correct. To the Prophet that we believe. Correct. 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 And then again the Prophet still tells them that no, you will not confer favor on me by becoming Muslim. Rather it's God who has conferred the favor upon you by guiding you to Iman.
Correct.
Now, because God has responded to their claim that they have conferred with favor, one could ask, shouldn't the response by God be Wallahi Yamunu Alaykum and Hadafun bin Islam rather than bin Iman?
Correct. So after they say that they haven't done a favor to Allah, balillahu yamunu alaykum an hadakum lil iman. Basically the way I don't know if we'll have time to go into the detailed discussion of it, but basically the way the scholars interpret this verse or explain the reason or rationale why Allah formulates this response in this particular way is not that Allah is confirming that they are believers. It's basically saying that you think that you're mu'min, you think you have iman, you think that, but Allah says that
Think about this if you are people of truth. So Allah is not confirming that they're mu'min. Allah is saying that if you really think you're truthful, then you're mu'min, then you basically need to judge it by yourself. So Allah is almost throwing it back in the form to them as a rhetorical question. He's not saying that I say you're a mu'min. He's saying that if you really think you're believers and this is what you claim, then sort of think about what you're claiming if you're truthful in your speech. Because I'm giving you an example of what iman is, of what Islam is. And so no, Allah is basically throwing this question back in their corner, saying that you really think you're mu'mins, these are all the things you have to do. Now, think about it. If you're really people of truth, are you still thinking of yourself to be a mu'min? So Allah is not confirming that they are believers. He's not saying that, you know, when it says, بَلِلَّهُ يَمُنُّ عَلَيْكُمْ أَنْ حَدَاكُمْ لِلْإِمَانِ إِن كُنْتُمْ صَادِقِينَ. Allah is basically giving it back to them in a rhetorical question. Not to confirm them, but saying, well, you say you're a mu'min. You say you're a believer. Are you really true in it? Do you do all of this to say that you're a mu'min? Right? So it's in the form of a rhetorical question back to them. Not that Allah is confirming that they are believers or those who have iman necessarily. Yeah. We close and we ask Allah that He gives us the blessings to read and understand and implement the Quran in our day-to-day lives. We ask Allah to forgive us any of our slips and blunders as we are on this path of Islam. We ask Allah to forgive us, our parents, our grandparents, those who have come before us. We ask Allah to give all of those who brought us into Islam from whatever tradition we followed previously, that Allah confers His blessings upon them for guiding us to the path of Islam, and especially the teachings of Muhammad and Ali Muhammad. We ask Allah to give the thawab of this majlis tonight and of the Surah Yasin and Dua Kumail to all of the marhumin whose names we had seen on the screen, and to all of the marhumin whose names weren't up there, from our families, our friends, the ulama who have left this world, the shuhada who have given their lives for the sake of Islam. Let us close by reciting a Surah Fatiha, but before that, one salawat upon Muhammad and Ali Muhammad for the thawab of all of the marhumin, please.